Welcome to the Festina Lente podcast, where we make haste slowly to engage with great ideas and great thinkers. I'm your host, Kyle Alberato. In this episode, I want to share with you a recent essay that I presented to a great books group. This essay is on reading imaginative literature. And at the beginning of the episode, there's a little bit of mic shuffling and distortion, but it lasts about a second, and then the presentation begins. I do apologize for the audio interference, and I hope that you enjoy this essay on reading imaginative literature. So without further ado, let's Festina Lente.
Say a few words about the importance of reading poetry, especially epic poetry and imaginative literature. And so, take her away.
I'll try to be brief, but as I started thinking about how to talk about imaginative literature, I realized asking me to be brief about something is like asking Odysseus not to weep at the bard singing of Troy. And so, I'll do my best. I'm no Peter Kraft, who can read a talk as if he's sitting down and having a conversation, but to keep me from going too far astray, I'm gonna read. Good. All right, on reading imaginative literature, Mortimer Adler and Charles Van Doren observe an interesting paradox in their chapter on imaginative literature and how to read a book. They write, "The problem of knowing how to read imaginative literature is inherently much more difficult than the problem of knowing how to read expository books. Nevertheless, it seems to be a fact that such skill is more widely possessed than the art of reading science and philosophy, politics, economics, and history. How can this be true?" I tend to agree with their assessment of the paradox. I encounter far more students and adults alike who are serious about reading imaginative literature, but I don't often encounter serious readers of expository works. What is Adler and Van Doren's explanation of the paradox? They write, "Imaginative literature primarily pleases rather than teaches. It is much easier to be pleased than taught, but much harder to know why one is pleased. Beauty is harder to analyze than truth." And so it strikes me as worthwhile, or a worthwhile endeavor to Festina Lente, to make haste slowly, to unpack this paradox a bit, to till the soil of having a great conversation about imaginative literature. So why is beauty harder to analyze than truth? This question presumes the claim that beauty, in fact, is harder to analyze than truth. Placing this claim under scrutiny highlights the comparative difficulty of reading imaginative literature. Let's define our terms. Truth and beauty fall into the category of transcendentals, though there is debate in the Western canon of whether or not beauty is a member of the category. Transcendentals are properties of being defined by their universal presence in varying degrees in everything that exists. Transcendentals permeate the entirety of human experience and so have tremendous value in rendering our intellect more docile to reality, more open to being. Stratford Caldecott, in his book on the Trivium, entitled Beauty in the Word, offers a helpful classification of the transcendentals as they relate to being. He outlines four transcendentals, but recognizes that there is fruitful debate among great thinkers about the enumeration and the identification of the transcendentals. The four he describes are unity, truth, goodness, and beauty. Unity. So for Caldecott, unity refers to being as it is. The intrinsic unity of a thing gives us access to what it is and to its interconnectedness to what it is not. Truth. Truth is being as known. We arrive at truth when our mind accords with reality. Goodness. Goodness is being as willed or loved. The exercise of our will toward good things made known by truth increases our capacity to enter freely into the unity of being. Of these three, Caldecott writes, quote, "For as we have seen at the most profound level, these involve an awakening to unity in being, known as truth, and communicated in goodness," end quote. Beauty stands out as the most accessible experience of being, but also the most difficult to pin down as a disposition toward being. We live in an age that has lost its confidence in truth, made goodness a polemical or partisan category, and has denied or ignored the unity of being through separating or discarding aspects of being. So, for example, Cartesian dualism or material reductionism. With all of that said, it's remarkable that beauty remains in our age, for the most part, a valid human experience of being. In other words, beauty remains socially acceptable and meaningful, whereas truth, goodness, and unity have declined in their social acceptance as meaningful. However, it is a challenge to describe the universal nature of beauty as it relates to being. Caldecott attempts a description by writing, quote, "Beauty is coherence, harmony, proportion, fulfillment, perfect integration. In comparison with the others, I would say that beauty is being as enjoyed, as rejoiced in," end quote. Beauty is seen here as more than in the eye of the beholder. It is the bridge between the Kantian categories of noumena and phenomena, reality as it is and reality as we experience it. This invites a deeper reading of St. Thomas Aquinas' view of beauty as that which delights in being beheld. Something beautiful takes us outside of ourselves to a joy in that which gives light, while at the same time penetrating deep within us to evoke a desire for something more. Caldecott writes, "Our experience of beauty liberates or expands us beyond the boundaries of the self. The encounter with it arouses the desire to unite ourselves with it in order to become more than we are. At the same time, it may strike us as more than we deserve, or more than we have a right to expect." Okay, so now with our terms laid out, let's return to the question of whether beauty is harder to analyze than truth, and why. Truth unfolds through the intelligibility of being, an invitation to better see. Beauty unfolds through the gratuitous nature of being as an encounter with existence as gift, an invitation to the gratitude that is the joy and the foundation of ordered experience. Gratitude is a disposition that evokes wonder and joy in the midst of great trial and tribulation, and so is often the underlying structure of great stories. Truth is analyzed as we experiment, so to speak, with order. The analysis unfolds as we experience things as true. However, the analysis of beauty cannot happen while we experience beautiful things. Putting beauty under a microscope takes us out of the experience of beauty. Scrutinizing a beautiful movie while you are watching, or a beautiful piece of music as you are listening, or a beautiful book while you are reading, takes you away from the watching, listening, and reading. Beauty is harder to analyze than truth because it cannot co-occur with the experience of a beautiful thing, as the analysis of truth can co-occur with the experience of a true thing. So reading imaginative literature is more accessible and yet more difficult to analyze than expository literature, because it primarily pleases rather than teaches. As Adler and Van Doren note, it is much easier to be pleased, but much more difficult to know why one is pleased. Similar to the encounter of beauty, encountering imaginative literature cannot be analyzed while being experienced. Imaginative writers try to communicate an experience over and above conveying knowledge. Adler and Van Doren strongly suggest that readers of imaginative literature avoid resisting, quote, "the effect that a work of imaginative literature has on you," end quote. Before the experience of imaginative literature can be analyzed, it must first move you. Like beauty, the experience must liberate or expand you, moving you outside of the self before it can be judged. Yet, it must be judged at some point in order to be fully encountered. Actively engaging with imaginative literature involves being a demanding reader. Being a demanding reader of imaginative literature involves becoming docile to the experience the author is communicating. But this begs the question, how does an active, demanding reader become docile to this experience? There are four basic questions every demanding reader must ask of a book as the essence of active reading. Adler and Van Doren provide what they call a prescription for active reading. Quote, ask questions while you read. Questions that you yourself must try to answer in the course of reading. End quote. They identify four main questions that best serve the prescription. 1. What is the book about as a whole? 2. What is being said in detail and how? 3. Is the book true, in whole or in part? And 4. What of it? The habit of engaging with these questions while reading transforms skilled reading into the art of reading. The art of reading is communicating with the author, engaging with a text at multiple levels, from the concrete to the abstract, from the personal to the objective. The discipline of becoming an artful reader frees the mind to more fully enter into a conversation with the author. However, these questions as habits of mind take on a different flavor when applied to imaginative literature. The conversation is more like listening to someone tell a story. As we listen, we identify with the story through empathy. Empathy with the character, losing ourselves a bit to enter into their struggles and desires. In a sense, our active empathetic listening drives us to become more open, more docile to the experience the storyteller is communicating. Adler and Van Doren present three categories of rules for reading imaginative literature. They're analogous to the reading of expository literature, but have, again, a unique flavor to their application. In order to respect the demands of experiencing beauty that allows for ordered encounter and analysis. The first category is structural, discovering the unity and part-whole structure. The second category is interpretive, while the third is critical. The rules for discovering the unity and part-whole structure are as follows. Classify a work of imaginative literature according to its kind. Differences in the manner of writing demand differences in the reader's receptivity. Recognizing the kind of imaginative literature sets up the reader to be attentive to the specific literary devices involved. And 2, grasp the unity of the whole work. Grasping the unity is tested through the reader's ability to say concisely and precisely the plot of the book, because the unity of the book is the plot. 3, discover how the whole of the work is structured out of all of its parts. The part-whole relationships of the basic units of a story, the characters, the setting, the plot, it's one of the ways to lose oneself in the experience of the story, as we move from reading about to living within the world of the author. So the second category we have are the interpretive rules. The interpretive rules are applied through the poetic mode of knowing, as opposed to an analytical mode of knowing. We gain knowledge in the poetic mode as a kind of active passivity. We receive the interpretive elements through a receptive experience of the story, rather than searching them out through an active analysis. So these three rules are as follows. 1. Become acquainted with the elements of fiction, which are its episodes and incidents, its characters and their thoughts, speeches, feelings, and actions. The second rule, become at home in this imaginary world. Know it as if you were an observer on the scene. Become a member of its population, willing to befriend its characters and able to participate in its happenings by sympathetic insight, as you would do in the actions and sufferings of a friend. And 3, have your finger on the pulse of the narrative. Be sensitive to its very beat. Once you dwell in the world of the story and have befriended the characters, follow them through their adventures. And now we have the third set of rules, the critical rules for reading fiction. 1. Don't criticize imaginative writing until you fully appreciate what the author has tried to make you experience. And to be clear, Adler and Van Doren have a very precise meaning of the word appreciation. As an educator, I feel pretty obliged to amend for the sins of my colleagues who use the term to basically create a vacuous, egotistical, and narcissistic sense of pursuing things. So, Adler and Van Doren pin down appreciation as this. By appreciation, we mean having the experiences the author tried to produce for you, by working on your emotions and imagination. Thus, you cannot appreciate a novel by reading it passively. Indeed, as we have remarked, you must read it passionately, any more than you can understand a philosophical book that way. The second rule for approaching imaginative literature critically is to competently exercise judgment. Say whether you like or dislike the book and why. Third rule, objectify your reactions by pointing to those things in the book that caused them. And 4, pass from saying what you like or dislike and why to saying what is good or bad about the book and why. The three categories of rules for reading imaginative literature set you up to become docile to the experience the author is trying to convey. This experience will be primarily subjective and personal, but what causes the experience is transcendental. The mind is nourished by its connection to reality, but starves when its operations are stunted by staying in the realm of the subjective. This is why it is so important to arrive at an explanation for why you like or dislike the story. Beauty is what delights in being beheld. There must be an intentional looking through the story to behold what the story illuminates. Being moved by a story occurs when a desire for greater unity, truth, or goodness is stirred within the reader. Our passions and desires are directed. But caution. If we don't question the direction of this movement, we fall into the epic hubris of failing to realize that we do not always desire and we are not always passionate about things that will make us happy in the fullest sense. Not all desires or passions culminate in delight or joy. Anyone who lives an examined life will realize that many of our passions and desires culminate in darkness and misery. So without seeking the raison d'etre, the reason for being of our being moved by a story, we risk moving away from unity, truth, and goodness. Instead, we move away from what is transcendental and toward the hideously strong pull of narcissism. This is a perverse approach to beauty. It's an experience of beauty for self-gratification, rather than the self-discovery of gratitude. After all, the most beautiful things reflect the gratuitous nature of existence and evoke a kind of gratitude that becomes the foundation of joy and beatitude, which is happiness ordered to eternity. So with all this said, is it all worth it? In other words, why actively read imaginative literature? We can approach the great idea of duty in different ways. We can study the nature of this great idea in Aristotle. We can learn practical applications of this great idea in the works of Seneca and Cicero. But if we want an experience of this great idea embodied within human life, we read Homer. Here we encounter the majesty and the poverty of imaginative literature. Its majesty is in the transformative power of great imaginative literature to move us beyond ourselves into a transcendental experience of being that directs our passions and desires to unity, truth, and goodness through beholding something gratuitously beautiful. However, the poverty of great imaginative literature is that it's impractical. It's not pragmatic. It's useless for productivity in the workaday world. Sure, one could approach imaginative literature with these ends, but that would pervert and distort the whole movement of the experience a great author is seeking to convey. The poverty is that it is dependent upon the reader's capacity for leisure, for those moments of plenitude which speak to the heart of what it means to be human. Leisure is for those who are free, able to know and pursue the good. Freedom requires an experience and formation in what is transcendental. It is incredibly hard to exercise the right use of our freedom. The task of escaping the chains that bind us is arduous, messy, and terrifying. Hence, it is easy to be moved by imaginative literature, just as it is easy for anyone bound to distract themselves by rustling around in a tantrum of denial to the strength of the chains. It will always remain incredibly difficult to not just be moved by great imaginative literature, but to be directed by it, becoming a kind of poetic Houdini. And so, with the paradox unpacked and the soil tilled, let's start a great conversation. Festina Lente. Thank you for joining me in this episode of the Festina Lente podcast as we make haste slowly to engage with great ideas and great thinkers. Be sure to check out festinalentepodcast.com for a discussion of this episode, additional resources, and ways to get in contact and recommend topics for future episodes. If you like this podcast, send us some love by subscribing with your podcast player of choice and sharing this episode with your friends and family. Let's start a great conversation. Until next time, Festina Lente.